God. Raphael told me about happier things, too. The chateau's alchemists and magicians from 700 years ago, who could predict the future by the stars. They foretold the rising and falling of empires. He talked about the language of wine, how the vintners read messages in the leaves, how the roots and soil murmur secrets to the grapes. And under stress, when the earth whispers of famine, the grapes grow more flavorfully than ever. The vintners would purposefully try to stress their vines to make them thrive and burst with flavor. In his beautiful Fey accent, he asked what I did for fun. All I could tell him about were the books, but he seemed to like hearing about them. I remember the gold of his skin and the cold silver of his eyes reminded me of the sun's rays breaking through storm clouds. I stole glances at his beautiful pointed ears and breathed in his masculine scent, faintly spiced like cedarwood and forest soil. That gorgeous scent is all around me now. That day, he led me to the dungeon of Delurue's guard. He took me down beneath the earth where shadows swallowed us and told me the stone chambers were haunted by the Viscount. The guilt had driven him mad. When I was scared, I leaned into him, and he wrapped an arm around me. His silver eyes shone even in the dark. Half-lidded, playful. Beneath the earth, the air was freezing cold, but I felt the heat radiating off of him. I'm still cold, the air piercing me, shaking me, making my lungs freeze. Hard to breathe when everything stops moving. The air still as ice. We wandered from the dungeons, back out to the sun-dappled grass under a yew tree, and lay flat on our backs. Our arms stretched toward each other. When our fingertips touched, I heard words in my mind. Beautiful. Beautiful. That time, I wasn't scared of the voices, because they described what I saw before me. But everything changed after the kiss. The kiss told me who he really was under that beautiful, golden-tongued exterior. Warm arms pull me in close against a steely chest, and I gasp for breath. Everything is moving up and down, a rocking motion. Normally this would make me feel relentlessly queasy, but right now, I feel warm and safe. Magic thrums over my skin, making my pulse speed up. There's something particularly enjoyable wrapping around me. My eyes flutter open. Bare skin on bare skin, Raphael's naked body pressed against mine. One of his arms is hooked around my waist, pulling me back into his abs. His arm is tight around my ribs, and my camisole is pulled up to just beneath my breasts. I'm not totally naked, I realize. I'm wearing underwear, but nothing else. I think it might be the same for Raphael behind me. My exposed lower back curves against his stomach, and his legs are wrapped around me. Blankets cover us. I turn to look at him, and a tendril of my dark hair falls before my eyes. He looks back at me from under his long eyelashes.
"You're awake, Pixie,"
he whispers. There it is again, a note of sweetness in the nickname. A half-smile flits over his lips. "What's happening?" I croak. He props his head on his fist to look down at me, but he's not pulling his arm away from my waist, except now his muscles grow more relaxed against me.
"You had hypothermia. I had to warm you."
I frown up at him. This never happened before when I used magic. At least it wasn't this extreme.
"You'll need to learn to modulate it, and then it won't be as bad. You disabled the entire veil this time, for at least a few seconds. Hundreds of miles of a magical barrier. That was a tremendous surge of magic you unleashed. You nearly died, Nia. When we get back, you'll need a lot more training before I'm willing to let you risk your life again."
My gaze trails down his broad shoulder and his chiseled bicep, tattooed with dark lines that sweep over his collarbone. I have the strongest impulse to run my fingers over those inked vines, but I remember what happened the last time we kissed. "Is there any reason you still need to be in bed with me?" I ask. "I'm warm now." His expression shudders.
"I suppose not."
He rises from the bed and I steal a glimpse at him. He's wearing only a small black pair of underwear, and my gaze trails over his powerful body. He pulls on his trousers,
and I watch the sculpted muscles shift in his broad shoulders and back. His gaze returns to me, and I jerk my head away to pretend I wasn't staring.
"Do you need some water?"
he asks softly. I lick my lips. "Yeah, I think so." Still shirtless, he crosses to a table and pours me a cup of water. For the first time, I look around the room. Velvet upholstered chairs stand against mahogany walls, their surfaces carved with nautical symbols. Light streams through round windows over a writing desk littered with papers and an inkwell. I lie in a lush bed with soft blankets. Raphael hands me the cup of water. I take a few tentative sips and sink back into the pillows. "Thanks," I whisper.
"You saved our lives, you know. If you hadn't shown up in Alavur, we would have stepped into that ambush. Varys betrayed us. Either he double-crossed us, or they caught him, tortured him, and got the information out of him. How to summon us into their territory. Either way, he's compromised."
I let out a shaky breath. "Traitor Varys." He pulls on a white shirt and starts to button it.
"You heard a voice in your mind, and it spoke true."
"That's pretty much it."
"And this has happened before."
I frown. I always thought I was hallucinating. But now that I know I'm demi-fae, I'm starting to wonder if there's some magic at play.
He pulls out a chair and sits in it.
"Another power. You have two powers."
I swallow hard. Wraith says that when one person has several powers, they interfere with each other. Diametric powers. They're cursed and drive a person mad.
He cocks his head.
"And you think the voices tell you about the future? Like Tonna's ability to predict?"
My mind flicks back over some of the times I heard voices screaming in my head. Sometimes they came true. Other times it was lies or panicked thoughts, or just a litany of insecurities. Occasionally, pornographic thoughts boomed in my skull. About me, usually. Occasionally they talked as if I was merely a passerby listening to a conversation of someone else. With Tarquin, it was hostile.
"You need to be put in your place. You should have been nice when you had the chance. And now look what you've done. Whore."
When the sea serpent attacked us, it was a voice screaming that we were going to die. All of them were raw emotions. All of them were triggered when others were near me. "I think I might be telepathic," I said. "The voices reflect the thoughts of people around me, what they feel or think."
Raphael folds his arms, leaning back in the chair.
"Well, you're right about powers interfering with each other. If you have two powers, it might explain your difficulty with controlling your magic."
I nod, thinking of what I've learned. Two powers intertwined weaken and destabilize each other. In some cases, over time, they cancel each other completely. And in other cases, the person possessing them is torn apart, either mentally or physically. In less than a month, I've gone from being a bookseller with no powers to being a supernatural spy to having one power too many.
A line forms between Raphael's eyebrows.
"We will need to suppress your telepathy. If we're lucky, we can eliminate it altogether."
I've always wanted to get rid of the voices, but suddenly, I'm not so sure. My telepathy saved your lives.
He flashes me a rueful smile.
"And I'm immensely grateful. But like I said, you almost died. We have several telepaths at MI-13. We only have two sentinels. During this mission, you've demonstrated that you're on your way to becoming an amazing agent. But if we don't suppress your second power, you could die."
"Your bedside manner needs improvement." Nausea rises in my gut, climbing up my throat. I don't want to vomit in this bed, but I don't feel strong enough to get up yet. Why am I getting seasick now? I was fine a minute ago.
He flashes me a sly smile.
"Well, that was the effect of my magic. It didn't do much good to heal your magical affliction, but it helped with your seasickness."
I stare at him, suddenly wishing he'd climb back in bed.
"But you kicked me out," he adds.
"Perhaps that was a mistake," I say crisply. I turn away from him, pulling the covers up over my shoulders. I feel the bed compress as he slides in behind me, his body curving around mine. Already his magic is working its way over my skin. When I close my eyes, I conjure up the memory of being ghosted. After our kiss, I didn't see him for 3 days. And when I found him in the vineyards, he told me that he had lost all interest in me, that he had better things to do than to entertain a spoiled girl from America. Raphael clearly had better options, like the elegant and sophisticated women he spent time with at the chateau. Or women like
Genevra Pendragon. She's a Pendragon. No one would call her trash. When I was 17, I spent the rest of the summer lying on the floor of my room miserable. His arm curls protectively around my waist. For just a moment, all my thoughts narrow to the feeling of his skin against mine. Mentally, I jolt myself out of the pleasure. Do not let yourself fall for him again, Nia. I'd spent years building up my mental barriers against gorgeous men like him, and I would not let the walls crumble just because of his perfect body. No more thinking of Raphael. Not like that. He's going to end up with someone like Genevra. I'd be an idiot to think of him as anything else. Chapter 20. 3 months later. There's always a moment when I aim an arrow where everything but the target fades away. Here, in the combat hall, I forget the wooden beams inset into whitewashed walls and the charming crookedness of the hardwood floors. I forget the soaring timber frame ceiling, the towering windows that cast bright sunlight onto a room full of cadets. I can no longer hear the swords clash as they practice or the twanging of their bows. I block out the towering portrait of Merlin that hangs over the hall, watching over all of us. I clear my mind of the graffiti people keep leaving on my door, the words public bus painted in bright reds and blues. My thoughts go quiet, and the constant hum of worries dims. The fear that Mom has lit another sofa on fire or met another terrible man. I'm not thinking of Raphael or the way his muscular body felt wrapped around me all those months ago. There's nothing but the blood-red circle in the center of the target like an apple of Avalon. When I release the arrow, everything comes roaring back. All the sounds of the training hall, the chattering of thoughts in my skull. It turns out I'm not a bad shot. I might even be quite good. I raise the bow again and shoot one arrow after the next. Vivienne paces around us, criticizing mistakes she sees. When she walks past me, she stops, watching. My focus narrows again, and I forget she's there. The noise dims to a low hush. Sunlight streams onto the target. I loose an arrow, and it thwacks into the red circle, the shaft quivering. Vivienne lets out a grunt, probably the closest she can come to complimenting me. Ever since we returned from that ambush in France 3 months ago, her attitude toward me has slightly shifted. She'll still point out every mistake I make, but she has at least stopped treating me as a mistake. And I suppose by now I've proven my loyalty. Baby steps, I guess. I glance sideways at Serana, who's training against a man with long brown hair named Loic. He wields an enormous sword, swinging it with both hands. Serana's dagger looks tiny in comparison, but she's holding her own. She darts in closer, her flame-red hair flying as she moves. Loic tries to strike, but he's got the angle wrong. She grips his wrist, twisting his entire arm behind his back. He drops his sword, and Serana turns to wink at me. She can't wait to get out in the field. I've been on 3 more missions in the past few months, and each time she grills me afterwards, desperate for a chance of her own. She wants to know every single detail. Not that I have much to say. Unlike the first mission, I usually just hang around the Vale, waiting for the real agents to return. Since then, there's been no more leaping onto trains or lying half-naked in bed with Raphael. I reach behind my back to draw another arrow from the quiver. The sounds of the hall dim to a quiet hum as I set the arrow to the bowstring. With a practiced motion, I pull the string back, eyeing the target. As I release the arrow, someone slams into my back, jarring my elbow. A voice screams in my mind.
Trying to act like a real agent, you grotesque whore. Near Melisande, everyone gets a cheap ride.
The arrow flies off target, lodging into the wall not far from Darius. He jumps sideways in alarm, holding up his hands, and stares at me with a shocked expression. I grimace. Sorry. Someone tuts behind me, and I know who it is before I turn. Tarquin smirks at me, and Horatio, his cheeks red, is biting his lip like he's trying not to smile. Don't you have some serfs to harass or something? I say. I'm trying to work here. There's still an echo in my mind from his thoughts, calling me a grotesque whore. My telepathy, like my other powers, is erratic, but it seems to happen only when I touch someone. Or in Tarquin's case, when he touches me, since I would never do that on purpose.
It was an accident, you lunatic, Tarquin says. Anyway, if you can't shoot straight when someone gives you a little nudge,
You won't be much good in the field, will you? Perhaps you would have been better suited to trying to sleep your way to the top back in America instead of here.
His voice keeps growing louder, echoing off the hall. The hall falls silent, and everyone turns to stare at us. I bite down on my tongue so I don't say anything that will get me kicked out.
Or rather, he goes on at full volume, wasn't that your mother's plan? Passed along from one man to another until her allure faded and she descended into destitution and coke-addled inebriety. I looked her up. So sad, really.
He turns to the hall, grinning broadly.
Cocaine is expensive for someone like her, isn't it? Someone without a real job. I wonder how she funds her habit, living in her sad little rotten apartment. Have you seen the state of her teeth these days, though? Honestly, is it any wonder her daughter is desperately trying to shag her way up the ladder halfway across the world? Do you know what they call Nia back in L.A.? Slap a Melisande.
That's not even American slang, I mutter. Nor was it alliterative. Horatio guffaws.
I heard the nickname was Nia Shag. Lady Melisande, the cock-hungry minx,
Tarquin bellows. The eyes of the other cadets burn into me. Blood rushes to my face, and I'm about to lunge for him when a hand clamps around my bicep. Serana's grip is iron.
Calm yourself, Nia, she says. Don't take his bait.
You don't really want to come after a Pendragon, do you?
Tarquin asks in a mocking tone.
Wouldn't be very clever of you, considering we founded this place.
Ah, poor Tarquin, so frustrated, I say, trying to keep my tone casual. I've been on 4 missions at this point, and you, how many missions have you been on? 0? I wrinkle my nose and pretend sympathy. It's 0, isn't it? The amount that you've contributed to the Academy so far, just to be clear. 0. He snorts in disdain, but his fists clench as my barb hits home.
You're just the transportation. You don't really belong here.
Tarquin, Serana says quietly, if I see you get near Nia again, I'll sneak into your room in the middle of the night and cut off your bollocks with a rusty knife. He narrows his eyes at her.
Are you threatening me?
Threatening? Serana draws back in mock surprise. I'm just telling you what Tana saw in her cards. Isn't that right, Tana? Tana wanders over, her expression serene. That's right. Her voice sounds dreamy. Both balls in the middle of the night. There's a lot of blood. She closes her eyes, inhaling with a faint smile. I can see it even now. And the screaming. Tarquin's face grows pale. Everyone knows about the accuracy of Tana's predictions, and when her voice floats like that, it sounds downright eerie.
Bloody witch,
he snarls.
Let's get the fuck out of here, Horatio. We should have never let the mongrels in. It's like we willingly let the barbarians into Rome, you know?
He turns and stalks out the hall. The training session is nearly over now, and a small crowd is staring at us. My mouth is dry. What sort of person would investigate someone's mother in another country just to insult them? Absolute asshole! Serana is still gripping my bicep tightly. You can let go now, I say through clenched teeth. Right. She releases my arm. Tana sighs. It would have ended badly if Serana hadn't stopped you. Shaking with anger, I turn to collect my arrows. I breathe slowly, deeply. I have no doubt that Tarquin will tell everyone about Mom. And as I've just received a rambling letter from her, I'm trying not to think of her at all. I'm already eaten up with guilt at the thought of abandoning her, and from her unhinged scrawl, it's clear she isn't doing well. She's furious with me for leaving her. In fact, she doesn't sound much kinder than Tarquin at this point. I slide the bow and arrows back into the rack. When I turn, the hall has mostly emptied. Serana and Tana are waiting for me by the large arched doorway. My mind is roiling as I cross back to them. If I don't eat soon, says Serana, I'm going to end up charging after Tarquin and rage-killing him myself. We have 20 minutes until the next lesson. Serana is always famished between classes, so I've started making cheese and chutney sandwiches to keep her from getting cranky. I've got you covered, I say. I'm lost in a haze of worries as the three of us trudge down the stairs through the shadowy halls. But once we get outside, the bright midsummer sun warms my skin and calms my mood. Buttery summer light ignites the leaves of apple trees, and little baby apples hang from their branches. The three of us cross the grass, which is dappled with forget-me-nots and primroses. I subtly scan our surroundings, trying to take in everything and everyone around me. It's a habit we're all supposed to develop. Something draws my attention, a strange tug, and I notice a tall woman with cherry red hair frowning at me. She turns and strides away, and I wonder who she is. Not one of the instructors or the regular staff, but she looked interested in me for some reason. Tana sits beneath an apple tree, and we join her. I reach into my leather bag and pull out three sandwiches wrapped in wax paper. Sarana accepts my offering with a flutter of her eyelashes. "Thank you, darling. You are good at looking after me." I smile at her. "Okay, let's practice. How many people are behind you, and what are they wearing?" She purses her lips as she concentrates. This is an exercise we've been working on for a while. Spies should always be aware of everything around them and take in every little detail, even when they look relaxed. A spy who doesn't notice they're being followed is a dead spy. Or caught. And everyone knows that being captured by the Fae is worse than death. 6 people, she says. Gisella and Orin by the statue. She's wearing a blue gossamer dress, and he's wearing those leather trousers that look far too tight. The same ones he wears every day. There are 4 demi-fae women on the bench on the other side of the pond, all in dresses. 2 green, 1 purple, and 1 gold. Good. But it's not purple. It's more of a periwinkle grey, I say. She glances over her shoulder. All right, but I was right about the rest. Those really are tight trousers. Who's behind you, and what are they doing? Sarana asks me in return. I shut my eyes, trying to picture what I'd seen. Gale, Penelope, and Horace are standing by the old gravestones, the ones with the winged skulls. Gale is holding a mauve book and lecturing them about poetry. I open my eyes. Sarana raises an eyebrow. You can't possibly hear what he's saying. But he's talking, and he's wearing that pretentious expression of his, and Penelope is looking at him all doe-eyed, I say. That only happens when he's reading verse. Tana laughs. All right, Sarana says. Now which of them is carrying a weapon? I bite my lower lip, picturing it again. Penelope is. Slight bulge in her boot. She has a shiv hidden there. Well done. We both look at Tana. She sighs. Oh, please don't. You need to master this for the culling, I say this as gently as possible. I've come to learn that underneath Tana's serene exterior, she's a warrior. You've got this. I know you can do it, Tana. But the truth is, I'm not sure I believe what I'm saying. The culling is only 6 weeks away. They'll test our endurance, our fighting abilities, our spycraft, and they'll test my magical abilities. A cadet who doesn't do well on the tests is removed from the academy. Occasionally, they leave grievously injured. Or not at all. The culling is brutal. Avalon Tower can't risk sending out mediocre agents. If a spy gets caught during a mission, the consequences could be disastrous for all of MI-13. A captured spy could spill every secret we have. Sarana can barely pronounce Fae words. I can still barely control my powers. Meanwhile, Tana is having a serious problem with being aware of her surroundings. Even if she can easily see what's around her, she gets confused by when it's happening. She hesitates. There's a man behind me. He's wearing a blue tunic. He's smoking a pipe. I look over her shoulder. A man is lying in the grass in a velvet waistcoat, reading a book. Can you tell me more? Well, he looks like the man from the painting in the dining hall. The famous bard with the long beard. Oh, she deflates. He is that poet. Taliesin, Sarana asks. He's been dead for over 1,000 years. Well, he was right behind me 1,500 years ago, Tana sighs. This is hopeless. You'll get there. My chest clenches with guilt at the lie. I'm not sure Tana will get there. What about your telepathy? Sarana asks. Have you been able to get rid of it? It's going great, I say brightly. No worries at all. Tana cocks her head. She's doing the thing. Definitely doing the thing, Sarana agrees. I bristle defensively. What thing? Your voice gets higher and cracks a bit when you lie, Sarana says. When you're telling people whatever they want to hear. Tana wrinkles her nose. Which you do a lot. My chest tightens. So not only am I vexed with diametric magic, but I'm also a terrible liar. Not the best qualities for a spy, are they? Sarana grimaces. You're still hearing thoughts, then? Only when they're really loud, and I have to be touching someone. When are thoughts loud? Serana arches an eyebrow. High-intensity emotions. Is it really that bad? She asks. Having two powers seems useful for an agent. Don't you remember what Wraith said about them in class? I ask. Tana looks up at the sky and imitates Wraith's pompous voice.
In the Fey realm, those with diametric magic are treated with contempt, as they usually are driven mad. They become dangerous and deranged, ravening idiots who will attempt to feast on humans and Fey alike. Cannibals.
I raise an eyebrow. Exactly. And Mordred Kingslayer had diametric magic. He traveled across the lake from Avalon, broke into the castle, and slaughtered Arthur and everyone in Lothian Tower as they slept. I don't know if he ate people. He probably did. Serana's eyes open wide. In the very tower where we sleep? I had no idea it happened in Lothian. Tana doesn't look surprised at all. She's probably seen all this in her visions. Yeah, I say. I read about it in the cadet's library. After Mordred and the war with Morgan, they kicked all the Fae out of Avalon Tower for over 15 centuries. At least, until they really needed us. But clearly the Pendragons still aren't thrilled about it. And they're certainly not going to take any chances with another mad mongrel. I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm not popular with them at all. If they learn the truth about me, they'll call me the next Mordred. Serana frowns. But Raphael doesn't think it's a problem. Only because he's desperate for a sentinel. I bite my lip. And maybe I've led him to believe I've suppressed my telepathy a bit more than I actually have.
Bloody hell, says Serana. Please don't devour me in my sleep.
Tana takes a deep breath and holds out her hand.
What am I thinking right now?
I stare at her. I'm not supposed to be using that power, Tana. I just explained that.
Please, she whispers.
Surprised at the desperation in her voice, I take her palm. As I hold her hand, I can feel her thoughts blooming in my mind. But Tana doesn't think in words, like most people. She thinks in images and feelings and emotions and
darkness.
My voice is hoarse, and a cold chill settles in my bones. Death. It's coming. Something is coming, and it's going to destroy everything in its path. There's a single drop of clear blue water, and it's being swallowed. I yank my hand away, desperate to turn off the horror. Gods! I somehow feel angry, though I'm not sure at what. What was that? Is this what you feel all the time? I've never seen her with such a grim expression before.
Yes, for the past few days. The future is getting darker. Something terrible is coming for us all, and I think we're going to die.
A cold shudder traces up my spine. Overhead, the sky seems to cloud over. There was a little drop of water, I say, magical somehow, something that might hold off the death. Then a glassy clearness, like the surface of a lake? Moonlight glinting off it. But the shadows are trying to smother it, devour it.
Tana's stare is unwavering. Oh, that's you, the glassy lake.
I blink at her. I'm the what now?
To stop the encroaching death, we need you.
Because of my sentinel powers?
We don't need a sentinel. We need you, the Lady of the Lake. Do you know there hasn't been one in thousands of years? Not since Nimue. And things didn't turn out well, did they, after what she did to Merlin?
Tana smiles brightly.
But I think it's you. I keep seeing you in Nimue's tower.
She grips my arm.
You must pass the culling. You need to stay in Camelot. And you absolutely cannot get kicked out or culled, or we are all fucked.
I've never heard her swear before, and she does it with a sharp vitriol that surprises me.
What happens if she does get kicked out? Serana asks.
Tana shrugs, and her dark gaze flicks up to the clouds.
The future isn't easy to understand. All I managed to glean from my visions, and the cards, is that Nia has to stay at Avalon Tower and join MI-13.
Her gaze sharpens and lands on me again.
So you cannot fight with Tarquin. He's consciously trying to get you expelled. He's baiting you. If you lose your temper with him, his family will have you tossed out of Camelot. And then, I'm fairly certain, we'll all die. Horrible, lonely deaths full of despair and regret.
I swallow. Oh, well, no pressure then.
And you cannot let anyone know about your diametric magic,
Tana says emphatically.
Or the world ends. At least for us, but possibly for everyone.
We can tell everyone about your vision,
Serana said. They'll listen to you. We'll go to Sir Lancelot or Vivienne and...
No,
Tana snaps. You can't tell anyone. If you tell them, they'll try to keep Nia in a bubble, hidden from the Fae King. They won't let the Lady of the Lake out of Camelot, and we need her out there. We need her to go on missions, learning, fighting for us. We need Nia. My pulse starts to race. Hang on. What do you mean, keep me hidden from the Fae King? He has no idea who I am.
Oh, he'll know.
Tana glances at the gathering clouds again.
The Fae have psychics of their own. They will see what I see eventually. The Lady of the Lake. And when they do, they'll try to destroy you. But Nia, you cannot tell anyone what I just said. Not even Raphael.
Chapter 21. I glance down at the handwritten note in my hand. A summons from Raphael. Meet me in the Merlin Library. Sentinel training. My body glows with heat inside the tower. It's July, and there's not a hint of air conditioning in this place. Tonight, instead of Raphael's office, we're meeting in one of Camelot's many ancient libraries. As I reach a stone landing, excitement flickers through me. I'm about to see inside the very place where Taliesin once penned his haunting poems. And some dirty ones, too. About fleshy orbs, rigid pillicocks, and pearly showers, and other phrases that people apparently found sexy way back in the Romano-British era. I glance up at the carved mahogany doors. The metal knocker, shaped like a severed hand with long claw-like fingers, and an eye inset into the center of the hand, looks disturbingly real. If I were full-blooded Fae, I'd recoil from the iron, burned by the touch. But, as I'm demi-Fae, I feel nothing as I reach for the knocker. It creaks as I raise it and bring the iron fingers down twice against the wood. It's a moment before Raphael pulls open the door, wearing a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up. A tendril of his dark hair tumbles in his eyes, and he flashes me a half-smile. His silver eyes pierce me. As always, his masculine beauty immediately makes my breath catch. You're weak, I tell myself. Remember what he did. Walking past him, I survey the soaring ceilings. The 60-foot walls are covered with faded, colorful, and leather-bound spines marked with gold letters and esoteric symbols. Ladders on wheels stretch up to the higher shelves. I breathe in the scent of leather and parchment and faintly recognize it as him. Raphael spends a lot of time here, I think. I feel awestruck by this place and at one with the cozy flickering lights of the mini candelabra. At the far end of the hall, a brass spiral staircase leads all the way up to the backside of the clock. The ticking of the second hand echoes off the ceilings, the beating heart of the library. I stare at the back of the clock face, an ancient mechanical marvel, its brass gears illuminated by the library's dancing torchlight. The hands move rhythmically, ticking and talking. I can almost picture Taliesin in here scribbling away. But my task is different from Taliesin's. Unlike art, my task involves pain when I mess up. And there, in the center of the room on a carved oak table, is the veil box. In the little trunk, it shimmers and buzzes, making the hairs rise on the back of my neck. Raphael pushes his hair out of his eyes. The warm firelight caresses his beautiful features.
Let's get to work, then. You still need to master your control over the veil.
Why here?
I always do my best work here, and my clearest thinking. Maybe it will help you focus.
He gestures to the desk with the veil box glowing in the center. I cross to it, my shoulders already tensing in anticipation at the pain that awaits me. We've been training for the past 3 months, once a week. I've been getting slightly better, but about half the time, I lose focus and burn myself. Because of the diametric magic, my powers are erratic, crashing into each other unpredictably. No matter what I do, I can't smother my telepathy. I pull out a chair, and Raphael takes a seat across from me. He folds his arms.
Let's start this time by channeling into the creative source.
What does that mean exactly? His silver eyes gleam.
Everything on Earth comes from a divine creative source. The force that drives nature, that created our world, our existence. It's forged every drop of water and blade of grass. When we write poems and make art, we are conducting that power. its nature expressing itself in the same way that it expresses itself as an apple tree growing from the earth and the apples on its branches. That's where our magic comes from. That's the thing about magic, Nia. It doesn't really come from us. It's not ours, and we don't own it. It's a power we are allowed to use, a gift that doesn't belong to us. Do you understand?
I stare at him, entranced. The firelight sparks in his eyes.
I think so. You need to let it flow through you. Get in touch with the force that created us.
How exactly? I ask.
One way to get in touch with the creative force is through free association. Or free writing. Just say or write whatever comes into your mind.
What now? I ask. And he nods.
I'm already nervous. What does he want me to say? I'm usually so good at determining what people want from me, but I can't read Raphael. And moreover, I'm not supposed to be telling him what he wants to hear. I'm supposed to be tapping into that creative force, but I have no idea how, and I'm certain that I'll say something fucking weird.
Nia,
he says,
just say the first word that comes into your head, then keep going.
Rigid pillar cock, I blurt. He stares at me. Not a hint of a smile. Of course not. Because even if you were having the absolute time of his fucking life, even if you were swilling champagne on the back of a glittering unicorn, the man would not crack a smile. He has no emotions. My cheeks flame red. This is why I didn't want to do this. Can we skip this, please?
Fine, let's try it another way. Find the core of your sentinel powers. Smother your other magic. Suppress your emotions to clear space.
I close my eyes. By now, I can do that. My mind shuts out the world. Mentally, I dive into the feel of the magic, ignoring all the distractions that surround me. I let go of my everyday anxieties, the tiredness of my legs, the stiffness of the wooden chair, the hollow pit in my stomach from missing dinner. I forget Raphael's gorgeous face and the way he smells. Deep in my chest, I can sense my power. Two powers, pulsing with energy, at odds with each other, wrestling like spirits of the light and dark. I feel twinges in my chest as each struggles to snuff the other out. As the magic battles inside me, goosebumps rise on my skin. A gust of wind skims over me, though from where I have no idea. The sound of whispers flitters around me. Two voices, one angry and one sad. But the meaning eludes me. I can imagine how people with two powers sometimes lose their minds. The opposing magic is powerful, pulling me in different directions. And I feel as if my mind might split. In the hollows of my skull, red-streaked images flicker. The halls of Avalon Tower splashed with blood. Mordred's work. Screams echo off the stones. I swallow hard, trying to pull out the thread of my sentinel powers, to untangle it, but that's impossible to do without awakening the telepathy powers, too. Raphael has taught me to mentally see the magic inside me, to identify its color and sound. Right now, they're twined together. I think the sentinel power is darker. A deep red, like the blood Mordred spilled in Lothian Tower. It also has a slower, deeper vibration. The telepathy powers are more violet, high-pitched and frantic. Opening my eyes, I lean toward the tiny veil on the desk. I can see the magical net that created it. As I stare at it, I hone in on the spot that looks weakest. I channel my sentinel powers, trying to make them swell. Red blooms in my thoughts. The quiet buzzing of the veil goes silent. I push my hand into the box, and the misty veil snakes around my fingers up to my wrist, completely harmless. Inside, threads of my magic twist and roil.
Good,
says Raphael.
But if you can, focus for a moment on your telepathic magic. Contain it in a bubble, then shrink that bubble until it's gone.
I breathe hard, envisioning the violet strands. But as soon as I give the telepathy my attention, it only seems to grow, hungry for more power. Now the violet is devouring the crimson, a ravenous beast. The veil bites at my wrist. Ow! I scream. Yanking my hand out, I massage my throbbing hand, and a chill racks my body. My teeth chatter and I lean away from the box. It was working until you told me to focus on my other power. Pain pierces my hand, and I feel irrationally annoyed with Raphael. He holds out his hand. Glowering, I slide mine into his palm, and his healing magic immediately washes over my hand in a soothing pulse.
I lick my lips. I think it's better if I just focus on the dark red magic.
We'll keep working on it. But I think you have to be able to completely smother your telepathy skills in order to master control of what we need.
Yeah. I answer hollowly, my chest tight. I keep thinking about what I glimpsed in Tana's thoughts. The encroaching darkness. The tiny drop of water that gleamed in the shadows. The agonized screams that chilled me to the bone. Everything depends on my ability to control this power. A little part of me considers telling Raphael about the vision, but I keep my mouth shut. Tana seemed sure it was a secret I needed to keep. Do you really think I can pass the other tests in the culling? I ask. Fighting? Spycraft? Raphael shrugs slowly.
You don't have to be worried about the fighting test. Viviane told me you're pretty good with a bow, and as long as you demonstrate some rudimentary abilities with a knife and a sword, it will be good enough. Not all spies are fighters. And, as for spycraft, you happen to be very skilled at delivering to people the story they want to hear. Back during our first mission, that sergeant wanted you to be a timid and naive girl, and you sold him that story beautifully. It's the only reason your accent didn't matter at all.
It was your instinct, Nia, to give him what he craved.
He's looking down at the table, and I can see the shadow of his long eyelashes on his cheeks.
And that will be part of your test.
You'll have to persuade someone to give you something they wouldn't normally want to give up.
His gaze lifts, and my heart races at the intensity of those silver eyes. I am good at telling people what they want to hear. I never realized that living with a highly volatile addict would prepare me to be a good spy. Here we are. He arches an eyebrow.
With most people, you tell them what they want to hear. You're not always quite so flattering with me.
Well, Raphael, I worry that if your ego gets any bigger, it will need its own magical realm. He leans closer to me.
But why is it exactly that I am the only one to whom you show your real self?
My heart is beating faster. Because there's no point pretending with you, is there? I heard what you thought of me. Trash was the word that got me, actually. You referred to my mother and me as trash. Yes, this was a long time ago, and no, I'm not over it. I overheard everything. And I don't blame you, not after one of my mother's spectacles. But I don't see why I had to be included. After all this time, I can't quite believe I'm letting it all out. He sits back.
I never said that. I wouldn't have.
My chest tightens. But I remember it. Right after Mother got drunk again. She was falling down the stairs, and you had to help carry her back to our room. You had already stopped speaking to me. I'm dangerously close to mentioning our kiss, and I really don't want to betray how much I'd thought about that single kiss over the past 10 years. And we already know I'm terrible at lying. Anyway, you'd stopped speaking to me, but Mom was drunk, and you and your rich friend helped carry her to our room at the chateau. And the next day, I overheard you talking to your posh friend about how we were trash.
I wouldn't have said that.
Anger flickers through me. Not in English, but in French. Désordre, one of you said. People like us don't spend time with people like that. And the other one said, yes, isn't she trash? She and her mother. He nods, frowning.
Ah, guilty as charged, in part. I did say people like us don't spend time around people like them.
I stare at him. I'm not sure I see how that's much better. What do you mean, people like them? You've been making digs at me like that since I first saw you on the dock in the south of France. You said I should be getting drunk on champagne at the beach, or that you don't expect much from people like me. It's not really much better than saying trash, is it? What's the fucking difference? My pulse is racing out of control. No one in the world makes me feel unhinged quite like Raphael does. And it really doesn't help that he never displays a single freaking flicker of emotion, that I'm yelling at a robot. He breathes in sharply, then swallows.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it how you seem to think I did.
Then how exactly did you mean it?
What I meant, Nia, was we don't spend time with rich people. You still seem to think I was rich. I never was. Some of the demi-fae at that chateau were. But I was a fugitive with no money. I came from Brocéliande to the south of France with nothing, fleeing Oberon. I was literally barefoot when I arrived. And at the chateau, I was employed there to pick grapes. I wasn't a guest like you. I worked in the vineyards, and you were a guest. When I said people like us, I meant poor fugitives. And when I said people like them, I meant rich Americans. We were from two different worlds, that's all. And I'm assuming that you didn't stick around to hear my reply, because I wouldn't have accepted anyone calling you trash, nor did I believe it.
I swallow hard. Oh. I bite my lip, my cheeks burning. I'm not rich either, as it happens. That vacation you interrupted? I saved up for 5 years. I live in a dingy apartment with my mom. Walter was rich, the man I thought was my dad, but they never married. She used to find rich boyfriends, but the money was never ours. And when she got older and her looks faded, well, it's harder to find a rich boyfriend. I work in a bookstore, Raphael. Mom and I eat bargain brand cereal for dinner most nights.
I see.
His pale eyes gleam, and it's the closest I've ever seen him come to showing real emotion.
Perhaps we've misjudged one another. And you're not what I used to think at all. I thought you were.
Spoiled? It comes out a bit sharp. Is that where the princess thing came from? Pixie princess?
I really did say that, didn't I? I know it's not the truth now.
A line forms between his eyebrows.
So when you saw my room and you said it's not the sort of room meant for trash, you were referring to yourself? I was sure you were calling me trash.
My jaw drops at this. Oh, gods. You thought that I was calling you poor trash? A faint smile curls his lips.
Listen, let's forget all that.
He leans forward.
Can I show you something? It's my favorite part of Camelot, and hardly anyone else knows about it.
I was shocked to realize that, yes, I really did want to see whatever it was he had to show me. Just like when I was 17 and he'd invited me to see something at the chateau, and I jumped at the chance. Last time, such an invitation was followed by a month of me crying on the floorboards. After all, even though he didn't call me trash, the man had still ghosted me. Still, I wasn't a teenager anymore, was I? This time, I wouldn't let my defenses down. What do you want to show me? I ask. I see a dimple in his cheek as he almost smiles.
You'll see.
Chapter 22. Raphael pulls a torch off one of the stone walls and leads me to a large painting. I frown at the image. Another one of Mordred Kingslayer wearing his spiked crown over dark curls and a long black cape. In this image, he's beheading a blonde woman who kneels at his feet. It's about 10 feet tall and gilt-framed. Is it true that he had diametric magic, and that's why he murdered everyone? I ask. He sighs.
Maybe, but I don't think that's why the massacre happened. It's the prophecy, the one about the House of Morgan.
A chill skitters up my spine. Oberon is descended from Queen Morgan, and the Dreamstalker too.
And that's why they need to die. They were born with the same violence running through their veins. The moment they get the chance, they'll break in here and slaughter everyone.
He reaches for a book on the shelf to the left of the portrait. As he pulls it out, the portrait pops open like a door, creaking. He turns back to me with an arched eyebrow.
You're not going to tell your friends about this passageway, are you?
Your secret is safe with me. Holding the torch, he leads me into a dark corridor. Light and shadow dance over the stone walls, and the narrow hall stretches on. Where are you taking me? I ask.
To the Tower of Nimue.
I breathe in sharply. Tana had mentioned her name. The Lady of the Lake, like me, apparently. Tana had seen me in her tower. Where is it?
It stands in the lake, with a bridge leading out to it. Nimue was a powerful water fae, back in the days of primal magic. As Lady of the Lake, she was an envoy between the fae and humans. From her tower, Nimue gave Arthur his sword, forged from Avalon steel. And she gave Merlin and Arthur their torques too, from the same sacred metal.
So her tower was a meeting point at one time, I ask? Between humans and fae?
Exactly. Arthur met with the court of Merlin at dawn and twilight. In the early days, Arthur and Merlin worshipped the gods together. Gods of the rivers and oaks and the earth itself. But the other fae court plotted against that unity.
Queen Morgan, I add. But what happened to Merlin? Did Queen Morgan kill him?
No, but they say she persuaded Nimue to do it. Merlin was in love with the Lady of the Lake. Some said they even had a child. But over time, Nimue started to think Merlin was becoming too human, too English. Arthur's court stopped worshipping the old gods, and Merlin went along with it. He abandoned the gods of the rivers and lake and the forest groves. Nimue accused Merlin of giving away secrets of fey magic to the humans who wanted their land. So, she used her magic to seal him in an oak tree, and he was never seen again. They say his ghost haunts the oak groves nearby.
It doesn't seem like it helped the Fae of Avalon. A shudder prickles over my skin. They're gone now. What happened to them?
After what Mordred Kingslayer did, the humans retaliated with a vengeance. The Fae lost the war, utterly defeated. Queen Morgan was killed on the battlefield. Oberon was only a baby, so Mordred took him to France. And Mordred's mages burned up their magic, creating Broceliande, the realm where the broken Fae Empire could live in defeat. We think Mordred went mad after the loss and eventually ended his own life. He was already insane, of course, but it only got worse. That was all a long time ago. I imagine Oberon has probably been stewing on his revenge for ages, and the prophecy still lives.
An old mossy stone ceiling arches over us. Words are carved in the stones, though they are too faded for me to read. I'm enraptured by this place. My curiosity sparked. The hair rises on the back of my neck. I feel like I'm walking into the past, and part of me never wants to go back. Does the prophecy worry you?
Not if we destroy the House of Morgan. I couldn't keep my parents safe, but I can keep this place safe.
He glances at me, his eyes gleaming in the dark.
One day, I plan to end her bloodline.
I want to ask him more, but we're already at the end of the passage. He slides the torch into a wall bracket, and the light wavers over a small red door. It's tiny, almost like it's made for children. Raphael bends down and pushes through. The fresh air sweeps over me as he leads me out and onto a mossy stone bridge. We're not far from the lake's edge, and the bridge stretches out far above the water with low stone walls on either side. The air is thick with the scent of oaks and apple trees. I glance back at the castle, and my breath catches as I stare at the sprawling walls. The dark, glassy lake spreads out into the night, a mirror to the stars. Lake Avalon always seems smooth and calm, and the moonlight gleams off its still surface. Tonight, everything is washed in silver. The hot summer air is sultry, fragrant with the scent of apple blossoms. As my eyes adjust to the dark, I can see old runes carved in the stone of the bridge, worn by time. Camelot is a vast and beautiful place, thousands of years old. I can't quite believe I'm living on the bones of so much history. Raphael pushes himself up to sit on the bridge's wide stone railing and pulls a silver flask out of his pocket. With a sly half-smile, he hands it to me.
It's very strong, he warns.
Is this part of our training?
It is.
I take the flask and sit down next to him, stretching out my feet toward the ledge. I'm wearing the usual fey attire, a sheer dress and almost nothing else. I've generally stopped feeling self-conscious in it, except for right now. Because sitting next to Raphael in the hot summer air, I feel acutely aware of my legs and cleavage on display. A cascade of stars spreads out above us, and the night air kisses my skin. So, this is part of training?
In a way. You need to get in touch with the creative force, and it helps to be in awe of nature, where you see its work etched in the sky and on the land. And from here, you can tune into the history of the place. The mead is to help you relax.
I take a sip of it. It's drier than the mead in the dining hall, and the sting of alcohol burns my throat. This is strong.
Don't have too much, or you'll lose your inhibitions. And I know how Americans get when you lose control.
We're not as bad as the English, I mutter. Already the drink is warming my chest. I take another sip. You think my problem is that I have too many inhibitions? He nods.
You're a bit tightly wound.
My jaw tightens. Maybe I'm a bit disoriented. My life has been moving too fast for the past 4 months. One minute I'm on vacation, the next I'm on a boat getting attacked by a sea monster, and I stop myself short. I don't want to talk about the deranged, scrawled letter I got from my mother today. She told me that if I didn't return home, she would die. My mother is a master of the guilt trip. It's not clear from the letter how she would die, but there are allusions to walking into the sea.
What is it that you're not saying?
He leans forward, his eyes gleaming with curiosity. What happened to your family? I ask, deflecting. He winces, nearly imperceptibly.
My mother raised me. My father was never in the picture. Oberon considered my human mother an enemy of the crown, even though she hardly had any money. I don't understand what he had against her, except that he blamed all his failures on humans. And she was human.
He leans back against the wall and stares out at the river. Sensing he needs a drink, I hand him the flask. He takes a sip.
We didn't realize how far he was going to go. This was before the invasion of France, when our world was still secret. And we never imagined. My mom thought if she just kept quiet, he'd leave her alone. So we kept to ourselves. But one day, Oberon's soldiers raided our home. There was no trial, no jury, no chance to repent. Dawn broke and they slaughtered my mom in the garden.
His jaw clenches, but he keeps talking as if he's forgotten I'm there.
We'd all been in bed. Then someone knocked on the door.
He takes another sip.
They wanted to kill everyone in the house. My sister screamed at me to run to the forest, that Mom was gone, and they were after us. I ran. I thought she was behind me.
A line forms between his eyebrows.
She wasn't. I ran back to find her, but I couldn't find her anywhere.
My chest aches. How old were you?
9. My sister was 16.
I swallow hard. And you never found her? He hands me the mead.
I kept searching the forest, living off berries and water from the stream. She never came. I think I was half dead when a demi-fae family found me and took me with them to France. It was really amazing luck, I suppose. I was heartbroken, but they brought me to the chateau with them, and I started working, picking grapes.
He glances at me.
You know the rest. And now this is my home, and I will defend it with my life.
This is a different side to Raphael. A softer side I've never seen. I don't think he lets many people see the real Raphael. The thought sends warmth spilling through my chest.
Now you,
he says softly. I take another sip of the mead and lick my lips. I'm not sure my mother is going to make it without me.
Why?
Because she needs me to look after her.
She's convinced you of that.
There's a lump in my throat. It's also, unfortunately, true.
You get your own life. Demi-fae live for a long time, but even we die someday. You have to die when it's your time, and no one else can do it for you. That means you need to live for yourself, too.
So is that who you're living for? Just yourself? The wind toys with his hair.
No.
Ah, you don't take your own advice.
We have different situations.
I stare out across Lake Avalon.